ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This conversation includes content that may be sensitive for some listeners. Please take care when listening.
Carly J. Metcalf was given a new set of lungs when she was 21. That transplant came at the very last moment to keep her alive. Carly J was born with cystic fibrosis, which at the time cut lives very short. She'd already seen many of the friends that she shared hospital wards with as a kid die from the disease. And in fact, even when Carly J was given the life-saving gift of a double lung transplant, the doctors told her she could hope for 4 to 5 more years of life tops. But the years have kept passing, and Carly J has now had those new lungs for almost 27 years, which is wonderful. But hers is no easy story of miracle cures and happy ever afters. It's messier and sadder and funnier and much more raucous than that. Carly's memoir is called Breath. Hi, Carly.
Hi, Sarah.
What exactly is cystic fibrosis, the disease you were born with?
Cystic fibrosis, we're born without a certain protein that makes secretions of the body thin. So our mucus and what have you, you know, in our lungs is very, very thick and it's incredibly hard to clear. So that leads to infection after infection.
And what had made your mum suspect that something was wrong very early on?
She actually thought there was something wrong during her pregnancy. She said, I just felt there was something different. But I was born with a chest infection and had failure to thrive. And it was just mother's instinct, I think.
She thought you smelt different.
Yeah, and tasted different. Yeah, because CF, we're salty. So we excrete a lot of salt through our skin.
And so what did she have to do with you to get a diagnosis?
We did a sweat test. She put me in a boiling hot car in February, which is brutal heat in Brisbane, wrapped me in a blanket and sat with me in the back seat. And I said to her, did I cry? She said, no, you were just... You're really chilled out. You're really happy.
And so, that was to make you sweat.
That's right.
So that they could test that.
Yeah, so they could measure the amount of sodium in the sweat. Yeah.
Once you got that diagnosis of cystic fibrosis of CF, what were your parents told was the prognosis for their little baby daughter?
Not good. Cystic fibrosis in the 70s. I remember going to the adults ward in the Royal Brisbane and there were no adults there because no one grew into adulthood. So it was looking fairly grim.
So did that mean that your mum and dad kept you in cotton wool at home as a little kid?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not, no. It was, you know, for want of a better word, I had a very normal childhood, you know, riding my bike, catching up with friends, school, chores. So, yeah, I wasn't treated any differently. And I don't think I wanted to be honest.
Is it fair to say, Carly, that you were something of a natural performer as a kid?
From the beginning, I was the entertainer. Always had a smile on my face, never complained. Because I thought, you know, what's the use? No one's really going to listen. And why be a downer? So, and it's interesting, I never thought, why me? I always thought, well, why not me? You know, and I used singing and acting as a mask, I suppose. And yeah, I would think nothing of jumping up on a table in, you know, the dining room of the ward and singing and putting on a show. And I absolutely loved it. It was acting and singing were my life. Yeah, I adored it.
So there was this terrible diagnosis in the family, but a lot of normalcy, a lot of happiness.
Yes, yeah, a lot of happiness. I think I had a wonderful childhood, despite what I saw in hospital. I loved my life. I still love my life.
CF, as you say, blocks up the lungs with mucus. So how was that managed day to day at home?
Well, back in the day, I would have to have chest physiotherapy, which is basically my parents beating me on the chest and expectorating mucus out of my lungs. So that wasn't fun.
And every day?
Twice a day, usually. Yeah, and nebulizers. I mean, you know, it was okay. It was hospital that was probably the hardest.
Well, how often would you have to spend time in hospital?
I think when I was young, I mean, I had maybe 5 admissions a year, but as I grew older and got to grade 12, I was spending a lot more time in hospital.
You were subject to lots of painful treatments while you were in hospital as a kid, including getting your blood taken. What made that particular procedure so difficult for you?
Because I've got terrible veins.
Not that it's your fault.
No.
Just meaning what, they're not good veins for taking blood. They're narrow.
They're narrow, and or they curve, or they move a lot. Yeah, so I've never had good IV access.
So in terms of getting blood tests or getting intravenous antibiotics, there was a lot of efforts to find a vein and pain that goes along with
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, yeah, particularly as a little girl, yeah.
You taught one doctor a lesson when it came to drawing blood. What's that story?
Well, it was about cannulation. He had attempted to put an IV in, and he'd tried about 6 times, and I hopped off the treatment room table and I just said, I think that's enough. And I called my mum.
How old would you have been?
8. Yeah, I called my mum and she came up, and he screamed at us in the hallway, "You need to start taking responsibility for your illness." And I'm thinking, hang on, I'm 8. So, and my mum, who is never, she never makes complaints, but she made a complaint to the head of the hospital, "Go, mum." And he was horrified. So we got an apology and the doctor said, "I'm really sorry. What can I do?" I said, "Well, let me cannulate you."
And how did that go? What sort of doctor was the 8-year-old Carly J. Metcalf?
I cannulated with precision and expertise.
So you didn't wreak a horrible vengeance upon this doctor?
Well, I did choose the biggest gauge needle I could find, but it was, straight in, like a trick, yeah.
And he lay there and let that happen?
He lay there and let that happen, and he had tears in his eyes. Mm. He was in pain from one needle.
So when you were spending this time every year, a couple of weeks at a time in the children's hospital, did you share a room with other kids?
Yeah, there were 6 of us in a room, and it was intense and full on and fun and awful, all of those things.
How did your dad one night become a hero to the other kids who were in there with you?
Dad would come up every night, even just for, 10 minutes. But one night he brought up KFC for all of the CF kids, and they were, he was an instant hero because we didn't have to eat the hospital food. So, and he would do that on a regular basis, either KFC or Macca's. So, yeah.
Nights can really last a long time in hospital. What sort of things did you and the other kids get up to at night to pass the time?
Well, I mean, we were meant to be asleep, but that was rarely the case. So we were running around the cubicle and jumping into each other's beds and we'd fall asleep in each other's beds. And we actually never got caught, which is miraculous. Absolutely miraculous, yeah.
So did you have a bit of a reputation, the CF kids, in the hospital for this sort of behaviour?
Yeah, we were naughty, but we weren't rude or disrespectful, but we pushed the boundaries. And I think that gets down to, we've got a terminal diagnosis. Friends are dying around us, so let's make the most out of this.
How common was it to lose a friend to CF when you were growing up?
There was a lot of death. I saw a lot of dying and death and suffering. I think I've lost nearly 80 friends to CF. I'm one of the only ones left from my cohort, which can be confronting some days.
When that happened, when one of you died, one of that cohort that you were spending all that time with, having all those adventures and sharing all of that with, would you talk about it with one another? Was like death something that you would discuss in those wards, the six kids together?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were so curious about death and maybe even a little obsessed because it was actually hidden from us. You know, if a friend died, we were all instructed to get on our beds and the curtains were drawn so the child could be taken out of the ward. So if you're keeping something from a kid, they automatically want to know more about it.
And what kind of hijinks did the cystic fibrosis kids get up to in hospitals as you became teenagers?
Contraband?
What might that have been?
Bundaberg rum, which is, oh, goodness. And we would drink it neat.
Wow.
Yeah. But other stuff, you know, we would go on adventures outside. We were allowed outside the ward, so we were allowed to walk to the adult hospital canteen. So when we did that, there was always some mad adventure. It wasn't just a walk to the canteen. It was song and dance and shouting and, yeah.
And I guess for most people, hospitals are this place that we visit rarely and it's strange foreign territory. But for you guys, it was a second home. So you must have felt like you had the rights to the run of the place.
I think that was it. Yeah, it really was like our second home. And we'd take our own doonas in and our pillows to make it feel a bit more homely. It really was our second home. And for some kids, it was their first home because they spent that much time in hospital.
You write about a famous ghost in that hospital, Adelaide Billing, matron.
Yes.
Billing. Tell me about her.
Adelaide Billing. So in the 80s and early 90s, the CFs were in a ward called Adelaide Billing. And there was this rich lore, folklore, about a ghost, and it was the matron, Adelaide Billing. So there had been sightings of her. There had been photographs taken of nurses, and she's, you know, there's a shadow in the background and it looks like Matron Billing. So she would wander the halls at night.
Was she a kind presence or a scary one?
She was a kind and comforting presence. Yeah, she wasn't scary at all. I did see her a couple of times, but like I said, yeah, it wasn't scary. It was actually like, oh, this is really cool.
We're being looked after.
Yeah, yeah.
So as you're describing it, you kind of were living a bit of a double life at the time. You had your life and your friends and school in hospital, and then you had life and friends and school at home with your family.
Yeah.
And in your regular life, you went to an all-girls high school. Inevitably, as someone who also went to an all-girls high school, boys become very important to you as a teenager.
Yes.
What did having CF mean for romance?
Well, I mean, in grade 8, I wanted to become a nun because we had this really cool nun at our school. She was only 19 and she was just fabulous. And then I discovered boys. So that was problematic. So I had a couple, maybe two boyfriends in high school. One I'm still in touch with. He's just beautiful. And another one that was a bit more serious, I suppose. And that was, I would have been 16 and in grade 11. And when we broke up, I just thought, I can't do this. I can't do high school and all of the death and, you know, a relationship. No, I can't do it.
How bad had the CF got by the time you were 20, 21?
So I was getting sicker and sicker, and I went on the transplant list the day after my 21st birthday. So I'm born on New Year's Eve, and I didn't want to have a beeper attached to me during my 21st birthday party.
What's the beeper? Why do you need a beeper once you're on the waiting list for a transplant?
The beeper, the little black box that you would pray and hope would beep. Because mobile phones, you know, no one really had a mobile phone back in those days. So, and I remember actually being at one of my best friend's house and the beeper beeped. And I called the number, and it was just some random person, and I'm saying, have you got lungs? And they're like, we don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, oh my goodness, can you please never call this number again? That was incredibly that was intense.
So you were waiting for this little black box to beep, and if it beeped, it meant that you would ring the hospital and hear, quick, get to hospital, we've got a set of lungs for you. Right. And being the party girl that you were, you wanted to enjoy your 21st birthday without the risk of that beeper going off. And so did you have a great 21st?
It was the most incredible night. There were fireworks. My dad arranged fireworks. We were living on the river at the time. And it was the most incredible party. And I felt like I needed to have that party because I thought, the next time these people come together, it's going to be at my funeral. I knew that if I didn't get lungs, you know, within a year less, I was absolutely going to die.
And how likely was it, according to your doctors, that you would receive a set of lungs in that time frame?
Not very likely. When I had scans done, it was discovered that I had quite a small chest cavity, and my transplant doctor at the time, Scott Bell, he said you might need a child's lungs, and that just about undid me. I didn't want to go on the list, but I did.
So you had this great knees up of a 21st birthday party with fireworks and champagne and it all. And then what happened that year?
That year was pretty intense. I lost quite a few friends to CF. One was a young boy, and I remember going into the dying room. That's what we called it. We called it the dying room because that's where you went to die. And we used to get in trouble as kids because we called it the dying room. And the nurse is like, don't call it that. And we're like, well, it is. So, but I remember going to see beautiful Jamie, and he said, I'm dying. And I mean, what do you say to a kid who says that to you? And I said, yeah, I know, mate. I know, mate. And he said, I'm going home, because he was actually going home to die. And I said, yeah, you'll be in good hands. You'll be in good hands with the nurses that we've got. So, and I remember walking out of there and just completely breaking down.
And then did you find yourself in that same room, Carly?
I did, yes. I was wasting away. I was incredibly thin. I think I went into surgery at about 40 kilos. So I was incredibly thin. I was very weak.
How painful was breathing?
Incredibly painful. Yeah, it's like having an elephant sit on your chest while you're breathing through an occluded straw. Yeah.
What about your mental state, your emotions at that point, knowing that, you know, this was it, either that transplant was going to happen or this was the end?
I think in the days before I got the call, I was totally at peace. I knew I was going to die. And I think I was just so exhausted that I thought, okay, this is it. I'm ready.
And then what phone call did you get in the middle of the night?
I got a phone call from my CF doctor, Simon, and he said, we've got lungs for you, mate. And I swore a lot. A lot. And I was taken from the MARTA to the Prince Charles.
How many people were in your hospital room before the operation?
There's about 35 people.
And this isn't medical staff. This is just friends and family of Carl and Jay.
Yeah, absolutely. There's about 35 people.
What was the mood like?
It was pretty upbeat, actually. It was pretty upbeat. I think things got serious once I disappeared into the operating theatre. You know, things were getting real.
But before that, I guess it was the adrenaline of the excitement, of the elation that these lungs have become available and there's suddenly this life raft has appeared on your shore.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you afraid?
Only when I was being wheeled away from my family and friends and I looked back and I saw all of those faces and I thought, I might never see them again. And I kind of let out this primal howl. I don't know where the breath came from. I really don't, but that's what happens. I was really afraid of dying on the table.
This was 1998. How rare were lung transplants at that time?
Brisbane had only been doing them, I think, for a couple of years. So transplant medicine back then was, I wouldn't call it rudimentary, but it certainly was nothing like it is today.
Still pioneering days.
Yeah, early days. Yeah, very much so.
You've seen photographs of your surgery. How did that happen, first of all? How did you come to be photographed?
One of my best friends, Sharon, was doing her photography degree at QCA and they had to do a year-long project, like a photo documentary. And there was a lovely little Balinese girl in her class who was also an intensive care nurse. And Sharon said, I think I might have the perfect project for you. And sure enough, Alicia and I got together. She would follow me around to parties, to transplant clinics, to all sorts of things. There are hundreds of photos.
And she came with you into the operating theatre. What do those photos look like? Describe some of those images of the surgery itself. What do you see?
It's strange. I see myself, but I'm almost dissociated. Like, I know that's me on the operating table with my open chest, but yeah, I'm okay with it. Like, I mean, I'm thrilled that Alicia was actually able to come into the theatre to take the photos, because not many people get that opportunity, and it would never happen today. It would never happen today.
What did your old lungs look like when they were taken out of your body?
They looked like dead bats. Yeah, they looked black. And I actually asked Alicia, I said, they weren't that colour, were they? Because I have a black and white photo of one of my lungs. And she said, oh no, they were black. Yeah.
Along with the images of organs and blood, the photographer, Alicia, she caught some really tender human moments in that operating theatre too.
She did. It was a six-hour surgery and I was in recovery and one of the doctors realised that I was bleeding internally. And there's a photograph, she captures the exact moment when he realises that I'm bleeding internally and that I need to go back to theatre. But what struck me, and it undoes me every time I see it or talk about it, I'm unconscious and on life support, but there's a nurse holding my hand, you know, so tenderly. It's such a beautiful thing to do that she was holding my hands, even though I had no idea what was going on.
What do you remember of coming to after that transplant surgery?
I remember waking up and I was intubated, so I had a tube down my throat and I was on life support. And I remember I tried to write, but the pen just went right off the page.
You couldn't speak, so that was going to be your way.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So then they brought in an alphabet board and I spelled out, am I alive? And I think there was my parents, my sister, Ollie and Laura, and they all laughed and said, yes, 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 you are. And then I spelled out, I love you. And then they put me back to sleep.
Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Losing a body part, gaining a body part, can do strange things to a person's sense of self. Did they feel like your lungs?
They did. Yeah, straight away they did feel like my lungs. And I feel a bit odd saying that. I feel a bit selfish saying that. Oh, they're mine, but I've always believed that it's a shared duty of care between myself, my donor, and my medical team.
What about the fact that suddenly you weren't about to die, but you could look forward to living, even if you weren't sure how long that would be? Did that take a kind of getting used to as well?
It did, because I was so close to dying. And all of a sudden I burst back into life, like quite violently. That's not what happens when you're dying. When you're dying, you die. There's no juncture. You die. So the fact that I'd survived was very strange and odd and beautiful and very, very difficult. So I didn't feel elated. After my transplant, because I was in so much pain and I was so sick, and that made me feel incredibly guilty that I didn't feel elated. I thought, you know, you should be so happy. And I was, but I was in such a state that all I could think about was, I'm in so much pain. When is this going to end?
Did you feel a kind of expectation to seem happy and elated for the people around you, who of course would have been overjoyed that their beloved Carly was alive?
Yeah, I did. I mean, my mum and I are very, very close, and she knew what I was going through, and Dad and my sister did as well. But I don't think my friends did, because I do like to keep a lid on my emotions. I don't like getting upset in front of other people because I don't like upsetting them. But I think there was this expectation that I should be, you know, jumping through hoops of fire and just being so elated. But yeah, I was in agony and really scared. I was really scared.
What of?
Dying again. I just couldn't get my head around emotionally, psychologically, what had happened. I was completely broken, completely broken. And yet I had been remade, so to speak, but I felt like I was absolutely falling apart.
And I guess, Carly, you were also grappling with the fact that there were all those friends of yours with cystic fibrosis who hadn't made it.
Yeah. I think survivor's guilt is a bitch. It is such a head spinner. I mean, you have this life-saving surgery and you are still seeing your friends die. And, the guilt is so immense. And I know that it wasn't my fault. I knew that that was just the trajectory of CF and my friends had reached the end of their lives. But, yeah, survivor's guilt is, it can be a really, well, yeah, it is an awful thing to live with. And I think that's what really did the damage psychologically.
You spent your 20s recovering from the transplant and learning to live, learning to think about the future too. And then you got another big health blow. You got the news that you had cancer.
Yes.
A bloody awful cancer, a rare cancer of the vulva.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, even for you, Carly, who's got pretty good gallows humour, this must have felt, come on, enough now.
Oh, I thought it was hilarious. I mean, initially I was really? Is this happening? Oh, okay. Oh, that's okay. We'll deal with what we have to. But I dropped a lot of C-bombs in front of my doctors. And, I mean, I think that helped them, to be honest, as well. Dark humour has always gotten me through. I figure if I can joke about having cancer, about my own cancer, I can joke about anything. I can make a joke out of anything.
Joking away, you went through the really intense surgery for that cancer. What was the recovery from that like?
As I said to my mum, I said, this feels like I've had another transplant. The pain, incredible. I had to have my bowel redirected, so I had an ileostomy. That was challenging. That was very challenging and very dehumanising as well, yeah. The recovery itself, again, it was brutal and I went into a coma and nearly died. And after I went into the coma, I think my dad said to one of my doctors, if she's brain damaged, then so are you. He's got a mean vigilante streak. He's the perfect patient advocate. He has saved my life, I think, about three times by questioning, advocating, and threatening to kill people.
And making things better with fried chicken.
Yes.
As well.
Absolutely.
The full gamut.
Yes.
Thanks partly to your dad, you survived that crisis. But the emotional toll of what your body had been through was very high. You describe in your memoir a period after this cancer surgery when you were actually looking to inflict more pain on your body. What was that about?
I think that was about punishing myself and the guilt that I felt at surviving when most of my friends hadn't, and also guilt about my donor, even though it makes no logical sense. I will always feel like I've been, like I'm culpable in their death, even though I'm not. But it's something I'll always struggle with.
And so physically choosing pain at points, I guess you'd think going through something like that, you want to be super tender with your body and sit on the softest chair and have the fluffiest rug.
Yeah.
But your instinct by this point, after years and years and years of really intensive medical interventions, was actually for a time to push yourself into pain.
To hurt myself. Yeah. For punishment. And then I've been addicted to opiates over the years, so that was another thing as well. I feel incredibly lucky to have come out of that alive, to be honest.
Those opioids, those intense painkillers, are not easy drugs to get clear of. How did you manage to do that?
I actually went on an opiate antagonist therapy, similar to methadone. And I was on that for a couple of years. Yeah, so I think my greatest fear was going cold turkey, which I'd done several times before. And it is one of the worst things to go through. It's hard to explain. It's like being set on fire. It's like swallowing a belly full of puppies. It is so many things, so many painful things. So my greatest fear was going cold turkey, and my addiction scientist, who I call the shaman, he's wonderful. He said, you won't go through withdrawal with this. And I said, okay. And I haven't taken drugs since 2013. I mean, I've taken them for pain, but certainly not for joy.
What role did some Tibetan Buddhist nuns play in helping you out of the dark, angry place you were at with your own body?
I went one day with a friend to Karun Hospice, which is a palliative care hospice service run by Tibetan Buddhist nuns and volunteers. And that put me on the path. I mean, I'd always been interested in caring for the dying because I'd been doing that since I was a child. I ended up doing some courses like spiritual care with the dying, and then I did their volunteer program, and that was life-changing. I walked into Karuna so, so frightened of both dying and living, and I walked out a free woman. I knew that I no longer feared death.
Out of that experience of, I guess, not so much confronting, but making friends with your own fear of death and dying, you went back into hospital, but not as a patient this time. What were you doing there?
I became a pastoral carer, a hospital pastoral carer. So kind of like a chaplain for heathens.
Is that how you'd introduce yourself?
I would, because, you know, I would get, occasionally I'd be screamed out of a room, I don't want to talk about religion. And I'd say, well, neither do I. And they're like, but don't you want to talk about that? I said, well, no. I said, I'm not religious. And that, you know, that spikes their curiosity. And they're like, well, how does that work? So, and then they invite me into their room and invite me into their lives. And that was the most profound experience and beautiful experience of my life. And I was going to go back to it when the pandemic broke out. But a hospital is a really not a great place for me to be. And that broke my heart that I couldn't go back.
When you were able to do it, Carly, if you weren't offering religious consolation, what kind of conversations were you having with people in their hospital beds?
We would talk about kids and pets and, you know, music. And I would say, just because you don't believe in God doesn't make you not spiritual. And everyone's spiritual about something.
Is that what you found?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was really my job to listen. So I didn't do a lot of talking. And I think listening is my superpower. So I did a lot of listening, and I loved that. I loved that. I loved being on the other side of the bed. It was a really strange duality, walking into a hospital and not having to get treatment. Yeah.
But being the person offering care rather than being taken.
I remember talking to a gentleman around my age who had a kidney transplant, but he needed another kidney transplant. And we had spoken for an hour, and he said, you have helped me more in an hour than a psychiatrist has in a year. Thank you so much. And that was, I cried after that. Not in front of the patient, but, I cried after that.
I guess that there can't be many people with a better sense than you of what people lying in hospital beds might want to hear and what they might not want to hear.
Yeah. And, you know, people don't want platitudes. They want honesty. And I would very rarely share my own story because these encounters weren't about me. They were about the patient and their needs. But occasionally I would share my story like I did with the fellow who would have the kidney transplant. And, yeah, people want honesty.
And I guess they want to be able to feel angry if that's what they're feeling.
They do. Yeah, absolutely. They want to be able to feel all the feelings without being judged. And as soon as I walked into the hospital for my shift, I would just drop. I mean, I try to not be judgmental. And a public hospital is possibly the most humbling place on earth. And you just drop the judgment because the person in front of you, you've got no idea what they're going through. People walking out of the hospital, they might have just said goodbye to a loved one. So be kind. Just be kind.
Back when you received the lung transplant that saved your life at 21, what did you know about your donor? Were you told anything?
I was. I did know a few things. Very coincidentally, my donor died in my friend Alicia, the photographer, in her intensive care ward where she was working. And I did say to Alicia, you know, this will never happen, but if my donor does die in your ICU, could you please tell me about them? And she said, yeah, of course.
So this was when it was all still theoretical. If I should find a donor, if it should happen, and if you're there, and if it's in your hospital,
yeah,
will you tell me?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
It did.
Yes, yes.
And so what did she tell you?
She told me that my donor was a young woman. We were pretty much the same age, who had died from a catastrophic brain bleed, and that she, her family had donated all of her organs.
Why did you want to know more about her than that?
I've always wanted to know everything. I'm one of those people who I want to know the best and I want to know the worst, I guess, to be, you know, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. But, I mean, I had another person's lungs inside me and I thought, if I get the chance to find out who that person is, I will be able to, I suppose, not live my life for them, but I felt like I could move forward with my life and take her with me.
Where did you go to find out more information about her, Carly?
I was 17 years post-transplant. And Mum and I had spoken about, you know, going into births, deaths and marriages and seeing if we could find out any information.
Because officially is it anonymous, so you're not meant to know?
That's right. It's nationally mandated that the whole organ donation process is anonymous. And I wrote letters and they are sent to Donate Life and they're censored of any identifying information.
And this is to protect, I guess, both sides in what's such an emotionally intense
time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I actually wrote my first letter. I remember thinking about it in intensive care. What am I going to say? What can I say? How do you say thank you? How do you say that? So I wrote my first letter, I think a few months after my transplant. And sent it, and I never got replies. I never expected them to write back ever because they had gone through the most impossible trauma, really unimaginable. So I never expected a reply and never got a reply, and that was okay. That was okay.
So it wasn't that you wanted to make contact with her family. It was more you wanted to know about her.
Yeah, I did. I went through a whole lot of microfiche and I went through was going through the death notices and I found her. And I just remember sitting there crying, thinking, oh God, what do I do with this information now? What do I do with it? So then I had her name. And I just thought, I'm going to Google her name. So I did. And I found a photograph of her. And that was, I really don't know how to explain that moment. I felt so raw. And then this other layer of guilt kind of creeps in, thinking, okay, I know that this was a person, but she was incredibly loved and she's incredibly missed. And it just made me so sad.
Just before the 20th anniversary of your transplant, you and your mum and dad visited her grave. Tell me about that day.
Yeah. It was a really blustery day. I remember being incredibly blustery. So we were looking for her grave, and it was my dad who found her, and he said quite gently, "She's over here." And I thought, oh my goodness. So I walked there, and Mum and Dad and I just stood there really not sure what to do or what to say. And the only thing that I could do was squat down and put both hands on her gravestone and just say over and over, thank you, thank you, thank you. And we didn't stay for too long. I left some flowers there, and we were leaving, and my dad planted a kiss on her grave and said, "It's all because of you." Yeah, and he was crying. I think we were all crying. We were all definitely crying.
How do you feel about that gift now? You talked about there being a sense of guilt. Not that's logical, but it's what feels emotionally real. How does it live in you now, that connection you have?
Because I know who she is by name, age, what have you, I do feel a deeper sense of connection to her and her family, even though I will never meet these people who saved my life. It's this unquantifiable feeling of gratitude. And I've really tried over the years to sort of trump gratitude over guilt. So to make gratitude, I suppose, win out, because the guilt did lead me into addiction and into some really dark places. But no, it makes me feel closer to her, knowing where she is and this incredible connection I'm breathing with her lungs. Like it blows my mind. It's 27 years this year since my transplant, and it blows my mind that I'm still alive. I cannot believe it. I mean, like you said, I was told you have, 4 to 5 years, at best, make the most of it. And that's turned into nearly 27 years of life. And it's strange to think about, because I never thought I would be here. I'd always planned to die. I'd always planned for my death. And I've outlived perfectly healthy people, which, now that's very odd. That's a really odd feeling.
Treatment for CF has been revolutionised over the last few years. If you were born with CF today rather than in the 1970s, how would things be different?
I can't begin to tell you how different treatment for CF is now. There's this fabulous drug called Trikafta, and it is going to make transplants not obsolete, but it's going to make them, hopefully a rarity. And when I found out about this drug and the fact that people weren't going to have transplants, I cried with gratitude, thinking, I'm so happy that people won't have to go through what I went through.
Is there something, bittersweet isn't a strong enough word, but is there a mourning also at all those friends you lost who passed away before that drug became available?
Yeah, there is. I think about my CF friends every day. They're, I wouldn't say they're constantly in my thoughts, but they're a hell of a lot. And they would love that. They would love to know that they are invading my brain. But yeah, I think, you know, being born with CF now, there's with this drug, treatment is nothing like it was. You know, there's not the constant hospitalization, there's not the invasive procedures and surgeries. It's, I'll use the term, it's mind-blowing. I never thought I would see anything like this in my lifetime. And it's here, and it's incredible.
Carly, it is really, really wonderful, miraculous to meet you, lots of levels. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
As Conversations fans, you love a fascinating character, and there are plenty in this story. Spies, lies and deception in an outback Australian town. The country's most secretive spy base is hidden on the fringe of Alice Springs. It's shaped a town, transformed war and continues to expand.
Pine Gap is almost certainly a prime nuclear target.
Come with me, Alex Barwick, to find out what on earth is happening in my backyard.
Why are there secrets that we shouldn't know? What are they?
Spies in the Outback. Check it out and subscribe on the ABC Listen app.